Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells on a beautiful sunny day. Great day to be out skiing once Mountain Money has concluded, of course. And the forecast calls for some more snow. So let's hear it for that and hope it turns out as predicted, unlike last week when we opened the show, Doug, saying we're expecting
one to three feet of
snow, and then it rained before it snowed. So,
but we did get the snow, which we needed.
Indeed, and this one's coming in colder, so we've got a better chance of snow this time. And we have, as usual for you, three guests, a national author and a couple of local entrepreneurs, and we will get started after a minute. Let me tell you who we have. We will begin with Denise Brousseau, who is the author of Ready to Be a Thought Leader. And Denise is an author, consultant, and expert in the field of leadership and thought leadership. And we will be talking to her first.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. If you've ever noticed, there's certain people that seem to get more than their fair share of press and following out there. Turns out that doesn't happen by accident, and Denise is going to give us a framework if you're interested in learning how to do that and to get a little more publicity for you and your views. Our second guest is going to be Patrick Lovell. He's a Park City local. He's also the director of a film called Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream, which is very timely. President Barack Obama talked about income disparity in his State of the Union speech last week, and that's one of the main points in Patrick's film. So we're going to have him talk to us about his film. And our final guest is going to be Jesse Shetler. He is opening up. He's the co-owner of the Boneyard Saloon. Most of us know where the Blind Dog restaurant is. And the Boneyard Saloon is going to be right above that. I guess it's a heated rooftop facility, which would be nice, and Jesse has a lot of experience.
And it's open, actually. It had a soft opening a few weeks ago, and it's open for business now.
Those heaters better be pretty strong if they're open
well,
now.
Well, there's a lot of indoor space.
All right,
well,
so we're going to hear more about that in a few moments. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Chamber Bureau members enjoy a wide array of benefits, including instant credibility, weekly newsletters with relevant information, educational seminars, webinars, and much more. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Larry Warren along with Doug Wells. And we have on the line with us now Denise Brousseau, author of Ready to Be a Thought Leader, as a question with a question mark at the end. And let me tell you a little bit about Denise. She's a leadership expert and serial entrepreneur, I guess you could say. She's founded Thought Leadership Lab, Inc., which is an executive talent agency in the Silicon Valley. And her specialty is building the visibility, credibility, and thought leadership of executives and CEOs. And she consults with Fortune 500 companies like Apple and Genentech and Allegiant. So well entrenched in the consultancy role and author of this book. And Denise, welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about the subject of your book, Thought Leadership. And Doug and I have several guests who talk about leadership and have leadership books that have become business bestsellers. What is the different spin you take in calling this thought leadership?
The way I look at it is thought leaders start with leadership and with being change agents. But the difference is that thought leadership is really expanding your reach and building a following around your ideas beyond one company or organization, beyond one community, but really trying to scale a point of view or a new way of looking at things or a change that needs to happen much more broadly. maybe regionally, across the country, even internationally.
So it sounds like a thought leader needs to be a self-promoter, a good PR person, or have a good PR person.
I think all of those things are key, but I think it starts, of course, with a great idea and or a great program or initiative or project that you're working on. I sort of shy away from that term self-promoter because it has such a negative connotation.
it does indeed. Right? I was looking for a more thoughtful word.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it as adding value in the world. You know, can you be out giving your lessons learned, creating a blueprint for making change, taking your seat at the table? Those seem to me like a better framework than that. I mean, I do think we sort of define other people in that negative manner, which then holds us back from tooting our own horn about what great things we might be accomplishing or ideas we want to share.
Denise, I had a chance to read your book over the weekend, and one of the things I really liked about it was some of the examples that you use in your book. And you and my wife were classmates at Stanford, and you both had a front row seat to see one of your classmates, Zoe Dunning, make history. And I thought it would be interesting and also share a little bit more about what thought leadership is, if you could tell us Zoe's story and how thought leadership helped her affect change.
I'd love to. And Zoe was one of the very first people I called when I decided to write this book because she is one of the thought leaders I admire. You know, here's a woman who started in the Navy as a young woman, grew up within the Navy system, but at some point when they started, Clinton started to come into office and they started to push forward this don't ask, don't tell policy, she felt compelled to speak up. She is a lesbian and she identified herself that way and decided that this was wrong and this was not the right direction that the military should go. She attended a rally. Within moments, it seems, the military tried to push her out, created a lawsuit that pushed her out and military proceeding, and she, in fact, won and became, over the next 17 years, the only openly gay person in the U.S. military. You know, and as a result, there were so many ways she could have proceeded at that point. It was hard enough just to stand at that rally and speak her voice and speak her truth. It was hard enough to be fighting a two-year legal battle. But more importantly, she then looked at that as an opportunity to take a stand for her community as literally the only person who could speak within the military. She realized she was the one who could go and advocate in front of Congress. She could go speak to the media. She could go speak to those who didn't understand the impact, the unintended consequences of this rule, this law. And so she fought for 17 years. And at the end, she stood with Obama when he was repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I really wanted to honor that 17-year effort and all the many things she did to push forward this equality for gays in the military and gays more broadly.
And you, as you say, she remained in the military 17 years after coming out. And one of the things you write in your book is that thought leadership is kind of the best career insurance policy you can buy. You make yourself more valuable by becoming a thought leader.
Absolutely, and from many different perspectives. Having worked with a career advisor here in the Bay Area for many years, I realized that this career insurance is necessary. There's always another reorg. There's always another change. Your boss leaves, et cetera. But if you have a following, you have a real respect as a well-known thought leader in your niche, not only is the next company going to want you, but your present company is likely to find the next position for you because you bring prestige and eminence and authority to their organization. You also have followers who can give you the trends and align you to what's next for you, helping you stay present to where you are the best value for the next company. And so I've just seen over and over again that when people really will step into that spot of being a thought leader in their community, they have a career path that just doesn't end.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, you know, you go to a trade show, you hear the keynote speaker, and you think, you know, that would be a nice path to go to somehow get invited to be the keynote speaker, to be on that path. So I think a lot of people aspire to at least get parts of that path, but they don't know how to. And that's one of the things I like about your book. You've got a framework of seven steps that you recommend, And I want to give you a chance to talk about some of those, but I wanted to start with, I think it's step number six, which you call shout, which is really getting the word out. And when I think of where folks stumble on this path, I think getting the word out is the one that's the most complicated and difficult for people to understand. What tips, what advice do you have for people to get the word out on their ideas, on their suggestions?
Well, I think back to, 15, 20 years ago when we had our first internet pages out there and people would create either no website for their company or their organization, or they'd create what we call brochureware, just repeat their brochure in a website. And, obviously it's good to get started. But to me, this idea of being discoverable is so much richer, that you have an opportunity now to get your thoughts heard in a well-trafficked blog site, such as, whether it's writing yourself on Huffington Post or being invited to be a guest blogger on a trade association website for your industry, starting with the small venues, maybe speaking at a small local Rotary Club or chamber event before you start moving to a broader platform, but also thinking about social media. How could you use a short 3-minute YouTube video to showcase what you know that your clients or your potential customers need to know? This is true for both people in companies as well as people who are small business owners or CEOs, because this idea is that discoverability, the first thing anyone does nowadays is they Google you. Whether they're going to meet you, whether they're thinking of honoring you for an award, whether they're thinking of including you in an upcoming event. So if you can't be found on LinkedIn or your profile isn't up to date, you don't have quality pictures, you don't have a presence with your voice, I think you get overlooked for many opportunities that could come your way.
Is there a danger among your colleagues, among your peers, among your bosses, that it does, though, look like you're trying to, work outside of them or kind of stretch yourself beyond what your job description is?
The truth is, every single thought leader I spoke to who worked in a company did do that, and they did stretch themselves outside their job description. And sometimes it had to be a skunkworks project. Sometimes it had to be a quiet sort of on-the-side program or project or initiative that they started in their after hours. And, that's not necessarily what I'd like to honor as the path. I would love to see companies really respecting and expecting and rewarding those who are creating these new changes and building initiatives that also showcase their expertise. But I will tell you, it's absolutely true that skunkworks may be the way to go to get started in some of these models.
Well, and Larry, I think it's a really good point. But if you have a boss that rubs the wrong way, but yet you're presenting yourself online in the right way and you're doing the right steps and you're not putting the company at risk, I think a good boss is looking for, how do I mentor, how do I build the skill sets and the people that work for me so that they can move up and I can move up? And if you find yourself getting in trouble at work, that may be a sign that you may not be at the right organization anyways. Would you agree, Denise?
Yes, and I also think that there's another attitude to take, which is, how can you showcase your boss's expertise? One of the people I quote in the book is a woman, Bontoon Quinlivan. She worked at a 100-year-old utility company, 80% union. This is not an organization that accepts change quickly. So she's trying to implement a brand-new program in workforce development. She's in HR. She could easily have just put her head down and done her job. But because she had this idea that they needed to make some change, some big change in the way they hired, she started building in all the ideas of the senior vice presidents in the company so that she could align her efforts to what they were trying to get accomplished. And then she gave them every opportunity to come to events, and she put them up center stage so that they could be tooting her horn. She'd give them the talking point. So there is ways in which to finesse this, I think, that is a win-win.
Yeah, I think of folks like, when I think of thought leaders, there's a couple names that come to mind. And one did the foreword for your book, Guy Kawasaki, who is best known to me, at least, as the chief evangelist at Apple Computers. I think that's, one of the coolest titles I've ever heard. And I think that had to be a pretty neat job while he was there. But that was probably 15 or 20 years ago, wasn't it, Denise? And yet he has remained relevant and out in the public eye in a very powerful way. What would, you know, folks like Guy Kawasaki, maybe not specific for him, but people that have succeeded in keeping their views in the public space, what percent of the time would you say folks like that are spending on doing the things that allow them to stay in the public eye?
I think it ranges. You know, one guy I spoke to, Avinash Kaushik, at now at Google, formerly at Intuit, you know, when he started writing his blog, which is now read by hundreds of thousands, he said, you know, he was spending 2 hours a week. He was trying, he had a full-time job, he had two small kids. So I think you can start there, and he built a huge following and got attracted to, by Wiley to do two books, et cetera, all the way to Guy Kawasaki, who I think is, you know, regularly, I see him all around the country doing webinars and invited as a guest speaker. And so what I would guess he's spending 20 to 30% of his time. But each time he does that, that's adding value in the world, which is what he values and which I think others should.
You know, a lot of the examples you give, Denise, are people in the technology industry. But I've got to think there are thought leaders in every industry, aren't there?
Yes, I think what I was trying very hard to do was to find, you know, here's one in the utility industry, one in the U.S. military. I had one who's a woman who was working to get more women elected to Congress. You know, here's I got a guy at NASA. What I was really trying to do was get people from lots of different walks of life to let people understand that thought leadership can happen in any community, in any realm, and in any expertise area. I have a guy down in, you know, Southern California who's working on growing gardens in South Central LA because he believes we need more organic food and healthy food and kids changing their behavior about food. So I do think it's everywhere, and that anyone could think of themselves, start as a change agent and then get the word out about the change you have underway.
You know, Denise, one of the things I liked about moving here to Utah, as you know, Linda and I moved here in 98. We thought, Larry, we'd be here for a year or two, and we'd be moving back to Silicon Valley.
That's what we all thought.
And then I fell in love out here. And, you know, one of the things I really liked was your voice in California is an exciting place, but there's so many other exciting people there that your voice gets diluted. And here, if you have a cause that you care about, it's actually a lot easier to affect change out here than it would be in California. And so, Denise, I think there's folks here that are passionate about various things. They are working to get their voice out. But I want to give you a chance to go through your framework in a succinct way. You know, what are the four or five main steps? I know you have seven steps. We probably don't have time to go through each one. But what?
No.
Share with us some more about your framework for people that are interested.
Well, I always want to encourage people to start with one niche. So finding that thought leadership intersection point, as I call it, where they have the credibility but also the passion to stay committed. It takes something to become a thought leader. It doesn't happen overnight. And the next couple steps are really about those initial efforts to build some followers for your ideas and test your ideas. Make sure you're on the right path as you're creating a new initiative or bringing change about. There's a whole piece in the book for anyone, I think, which I put as step four, but I think it's underpinning everything, which is that piece about getting over the fear you might have or the challenge you might have, the obstacles in standing front and center. You know, it takes something to be the person who is standing for a community like Zoe Dunning or just speaking for a broader point of view. And so I spent a good portion of time building out some rules for resilience, some ideas from lots and lots of different people that I spoke to about how they get out of their own way, how they take that seat at the table and get over their fear. Then I talk a lot about this idea that I had to learn in my career about codify your lessons learned, that, you know, the best you can do is to create some sort of a model or some sort of a framework for others to follow. We talked a lot about this put yourself on shout and how important it is to be discoverable and connect with others to build on your ideas. And the last one is really, the last step is really about how do you sustain change? How do you build a community of followers who will pick the torch and carry it forward? And also, there's a piece about really how do you keep refreshed and renewed and excited about staying in this game, because it does take some time.
You know, one of the points in your book, and I like your phrase, you know, it's important to be discoverable. I think that's an important soundbite that has a lot in it. Another point that you make that I think is really relevant, and I see people miss a lot, which is the importance of telling your message through stories. Why is it important to tell your message through stories?
What I find when I have been speaking in the world is that when I ask people afterwards if they've heard an hour talk of mine and I say, so what do you remember? It's always the stories. If there's something about the magic of hearing someone else's journey, hearing a hero's story of someone overcoming adversity or taking a stand that resonates with us. We see a little piece of ourselves in them. Maybe we admire, respect, fear, whatever it is. But those appeal to our basic emotions, and that stays with us. I think images is the other way that I encourage people. You know, find a great image that tells your story rather than just words, because I think those images will also call to mind that story again and that lesson that you're trying to share.
So let's continue on. We have a few more minutes. Let's share a few more of the stories that are in your book. Anyone who's traveled to a larger city has maybe seen zip cars parked along the street. Talk a little bit about Robin Chase, who founded Zip Cars.
Robin is a fascinating entrepreneur because not only is she a serial entrepreneur, but she's a woman with huge ideas. Yes, she created one of the first car sharing companies that was successful in the United States. But she went on from there to really impact both starting in Boston as a transportation innovator, working on a mayor's task force about what can we do to help increase the flow of better transportation and decrease the amount of fossil fuels we're using. That then drove her to more national initiatives, working with Al Gore and some of his global warming initiatives. And now she's really internationally known as someone who's impacting not just transportation, but these issues of global warming. And fascinatingly enough, now has moved to this whole new platform, which is calling Peers Incorporated, which is talking about these shared economy companies. So certainly her company, Zipcar, was a shared economy. Here's one car being shared by 10 people. But similarly, now she's talking about Airbnb. You know, here's one bedroom in somebody's back bedroom that's now being widely shared. And she's giving people how to build a company like that. She's giving people that expertise and creating a set of steps that you could do to create that type of company yourself.
Yeah, Denise, we were talking about telling stories and using images. You give a lot of presentations, and I've become kind of a student of presentations myself, and I wanted to put a plug out for another book. You may have seen it yourself. It's called Slideology. Have you ever read it?
I have, yes.
Yeah, by Nancy Duarte.
Nancy Duarte.
Yeah, it really talks about, you know, she gives you, here's some bar graphs and here's other ways to do it. And anybody that's interested in presentations, I think it's a must read. You know, one of the other suggestions you have in your book is that you mentioned that you like to follow people that you disagree with. And it's a habit of mine as well. I find I learn more from people I disagree with than people I agree with. Why do you do that, and why do you think it's important other people follow folks they disagree with?
I actually learned this from a training I took a few years ago, a project called the Op-Ed Project. A woman named Katie Orenstein was going around the country teaching women and minorities how to get their voices heard on the pages of the op-ed page and letters to the editor. And she did a research study that said if you write an op-ed or you write a letter to the editor, you do not bring people over to your side if all you do is state your own point of view. You must always state the alternative point of view and say, to be sure, you may believe this, being the opposite point of view, but here's why you're wrong. Of course, you don't use those exact words. But she said, only by knowing what the other person's point of view is, can you then both state it, honor it, respect it, and then differ and disagree with it. And so I really believe we need those naysayers to share that alternative point of view so that we can, in fact, overcome it, right, or disagree with respect and bring them around to our point of view.
Okay, well, thanks, Denise, for joining us. Interesting, kind of different take on leadership and how you can create your own niche in leadership by putting your ideas forward. Appreciate your thoughts and your book. The book is Ready to Be a Thought Leader, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Denise, thanks for joining us. Enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks. Me too, Doug. All right, thank you.
OK. good. Coming up next is Patrick Lovell. He's a Park City local, and he's also the director of a film that talks about the changes to the American Dream. His film's called Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream. He'll be in studio next. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our next guest is Patrick Lovell. He's joining us by phone. He is the director and producer of Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream. Thank you for joining us, Patrick.
Hey, guys. I appreciate it. Nice to talk to you this morning.
Good to talk to you. I had a chance to watch your film over the weekend, and I would classify it really as a documentary about the impact of the financial crisis and some suggestions of changes that we need to make, but I don't think I've done it justice. So I want to give you a chance first to tell our audience what is the film Forward 13?
Well, I appreciate you watching it, and I look forward to engaging you and finding out what you thought about it overall. The film Forward 13 is it takes the financial implosion of 2008, if you will, that impacted millions of us around the country, but here in Park City as well, as we all know. And I was one of those that got impacted. And I've been a producer for some time, well over a decade, in the media business since 1994. And I had just started my own business and my own company. And I had just come off of a pretty good run. I had created the Festival Dailies on the Sundance Channel. And then I went to work for a company out of Salt Lake, a production company, where we were building and giving away homes to people around the country on a television show. And we were 97% of the market. And if I pause, by the way, I'm getting an echo every once in a while. So I was giving away houses all over the country as a senior producer. And suddenly in August of 2007, the executive producers of our show, who happened to be a large commercial venture real estate company out of Seattle, went belly up overnight. And it was just shocking to the crew because, you know, we had a relatively sizable television budget, and we thought these executive producers had endless budgets and deep pockets, and suddenly they're upside down overnight. Nobody knew exactly what that was, and I had saved up a little bit of money, and things had been going really well. I just won the New York DMAs for the television show and other markets as well. And I decided to take the opportunity to start my own company, but had I known what was on the horizon, I would have tuck-tailed it and run the other way. Instead, what happened was I started to put my company together, and I literally put together an investment from a local guy who's built most of Deer Valley. I shouldn't say most of Deer Valley, but certainly a sizable portion of it and other developments around town. And we had come to an agreement to do a deal. And then on September 15th, 2008, I was literally scheduled to receive the first injection of seed money for this company that I was starting called Adventure Corp.
Which happens to be a historic day for, unfortunately, a not-so-good event as well.
Yeah, well, I was set to literally realize my American dream the day the American dream died. And I didn't know that at the moment, but of course, as your listeners are quite aware out there, that was the day, you know, Wall Street went upside down and the global market went sideways, and you know, everything just basically came to a standstill. And then, of course, what followed was you know, the government bailouts of the too big to fail institutions, and so on and so forth. And in the meantime, what had happened to my little family and I was we went through the spin cycle. I ended up having to go get two jobs apiece in the local service industry, and my wife as well. And unfortunately, those jobs at the time, of course, didn't offer, at least to entry level, if you will, you know, healthcare. And we have a family, and, you know, my income went from six figures down to literally nothing overnight. So it just completely evaporated. And I was just getting bounced around, and I'm a business guy. You know, when money's in the system, I know how to find it. When money's gone, I'm like a fish in a river, in a bed of rocks, flopping around like a dead fish. And I think now millions of us looking back, we're in the same situation.
So Patrick, if I could interrupt, we need to move along talking about Forward 13. There have been a lot of movies about the financial crisis. What different story does this one tell?
It connects the dots of the whole thing, man. Basically, the economy blew up and then got propped back up, and it's like putting Humpty Dumpty back together again. I went on a road trip, if you will. I made this film. I miraculously got funding for this film right as the Occupy Wall Street movement took off. And we went around the entire country and kind of surfed that wave and tried to figure out what that was all about while simultaneously just trying to piece the pictures together. And my whole goal was to try to get out of my space and find out what America had to say, and that's exactly what we did. But in doing so, we connect the dots between the financial crisis to reveal that really the status quo, which is basically energy, finance, and government and the revolving door of it all, are more entrenched than they ever have been. And that's pretty much what the topic of today is, disparity of wealth. It's an economic engine that doesn't make any sense anymore.
I think one of your subjects that got a little bit of airtime, not a whole lot of airtime, but I thought he captured the essence of your show in a very brief comment. And I think he was actually, you were filming him, but it looked like he was actually recording his voice on your iPhone. Which was kind of cool. But his quote was, it's no longer majority rules in America, but it's the minority rules.
Yeah.
Do you feel that the U.S. Democracy currently works that way?
Absolutely. And I don't think we have a democracy anymore. I think that democracy has been hijacked by big money interests that basically create a revolving door, and now America's starting to wake up to it. And my film is one of many that point that out. But that comment that you're talking about is exactly right. I mean, when you look at all of the gerrymandering and some of the strategies, if you will, it's to try to keep voter turnout really low. You know, if a certain party can keep it down to 30%, they win. And the whole idea is to choke the system so that government doesn't get in the way of big moneyed interest or becomes aligned with it.
And speaking of the government, I wanted to ask you, I know that you had enrolled in a program, I think it was a government program, that was designed to help homeowners that were underwater. And what are your views of those? I know some of those programs are still ongoing. What are your views
of
those
programs? Well, no, it was initiated by HARP. Let's be clear about this. I wasn't a part of any government program because, well, maybe by happenstance, just because the bailouts basically were, I guess, not in wink. Look, let's stabilize the market and let's modify homes. And so we were one of those people that got into the modification situation. And what that meant was, you know, they reduced the rate of our mortgage, and we ended up paying on that for 16 consecutive months. And initially, it was described to us by our lender, Chase, that it was going to be a three-month trial period, and I suppose to see whether or not we could make our payments. And, of course, we did for an extended period of time, and they kept pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. Finally, they get back to us, and they said, well, you don't qualify for, you know, the modification, you know, and based on what was the big question for us. But then we found out that they had us confused with another homeowner in Cleveland, and so they didn't even have our paperwork straight. So that was part of the whole robo-signing and mix-ups and the rest of it. And what's being revealed now, Bank of America employees had stated in April 2013 that they were admitted to being paid cash bonuses to take people into approved modifications and put them in foreclosure. And in my film, I interview a great developer here in town who says exactly what that is. He's like, what's a toxic asset when you write it down to zero? So what happened with the too big to fail institution is they basically triple profited on the demise of the housing market.
Yeah, you know, since you brought up J.P. Morgan Chase, this was actually a chairlift conversation I had with a ski buddy yesterday. J.P. Morgan Chase last year, I don't know how much, Doug, maybe you have it off the top of your head.
What
how
their
much
earnings were.
How much they paid in fines.
Oh, yeah.
In government fines. It was like,
I want to say $23 billion overall.
$10 billion,
and there was a $13 billion lawsuit.
There was just recently a $13
billion. So they've paid in the last year $23 billion in fines, and they still have the same boss, Jamie Dimon, and
That's right.
They doubled his salary as a bonus this year.
That's right.
I mean,
right. Well,
where
if you think about here's the deal. That's the cost of doing business, because the whole situation is that they're making. I think their net profit margin was $76 billion in the same time span. So it's like the cost of doing business, and this is what I'm getting to with revolving door, because they're all cronies. Basically, the guys in the Justice Department that were overseeing the case end up with jobs working for the big, too big to fail banks or hedge fund managers that are doing business with these giant apparatuses.
I mean, if you heard my voice raise, it's because this is just so crazily outrageous the whole country was taken down by this, and the same people are still in power today.
Well, and Patrick, you have another great quote in your film, which I'm paraphrasing a little. I wrote it down, so I hope I'm pretty close, which is, no matter how hard the working class works, they can't get ahead. And no matter how bad the decisions of the banks are, they can't lose.
I want to be clear about something. I am a capitalist. I believe in the ideas of free markets. I believe in hard work and integrity, and smart people rise to the top. I don't believe that cronies who know how to game the system because they've got a lot of leverage should be able to run the show, especially after they broke law after law after law, starting with Sarbanes-Oxley, what the Bush administration does. So we're living in upside-down times where the rhetoric is just twisted madness, while at the same time the system's gotten more entrenched than ever, and that's the whole point of Forward 13, because the colonies and the ideals of Americana, i.e., you know, all men are created equal, fairness, in order to form a more perfect union, all of those just incredible creeds, you know, we're not living up to those by any stretch of the imagination. And we have become, in my opinion, that which we were when we rebelled against to be born in the first place. What's the difference between this cronyism that exists now in the East India or the West India Trading Company and the English Crown? To me, I mean, it's kind of a stretch in a way, but not really. They're the same sort of, you know, interest, and that's not free market, man. They turn it all upside down, and everything is a distortion of what it once was.
So Patrick, I want to get to a key question, but I want to circle back to Larry's point earlier. And I want to share just briefly my view on it. I think the government, it was a very difficult situation. I think overall the government did a pretty good job. There were things that I think none of us wanted to do, but I think in hindsight we're glad we did. My concern is going forward, how do we prevent that type of situation again where the banks are not responsible for the mistakes they make? We need to change that, or that cycle, unfortunately, I think will repeat itself. But Patrick, I want to go back to my question for you, which is obviously you have a lot of energy for this, and I love that. And I think to be a filmmaker, you know, that's a path of passion. You have to have that passion. What is the change that you are hoping that your film Forward 13 can help create?
Well, thank you for asking that question. I mean, at the end of the day, what we've done is the film itself has turned out to be a prologue into something that I've created with some partners that actually represent a couple of former Wall Street titans that know the system is completely corrupt and upside down. And we've created what we're calling the Everyman Super PAC. And what that is to try to basically end this revolving door and Citizens United with a national referendum and the big money, which influences and distorts everything. And the point being is that you can't have so what's the answer? The answer is that we, the people, have to stop buying and voting from a system that's selling 99% of us down the river. That's not socialism. That ain't communism. It's pure free market. And the point being is that what we have, this is what the whole upside down paradigm is. The situation is corporate communism. I read a lot of Dylan Radigan. I don't know if you ever read a book called Greedy Bastards.
But he used to be the host of a CNBC show. I loved his show.
Yep. And he was part of the system since, you know, the early 90s. He rode the wave on the tech booms and so forth. And again, you know, his heart was in the right place. But after many, many years, he saw the defunct corruption that was just undermining everything that we believe in, meaning people that believe in free markets and dynamic American skill and upward mobility and those things that would make the American dream possible. And so basically he blew up in 2011 on MSNBC when he had his own show. And he's gone off and he's creating this thing called Team Renaissance. We're coming from the other side, basically trying to corral all of those people. And I can tell you this from the premiere we had in Park City. My film is like AA, if you will, for people who went through this economic crisis. A lot of people feel shame. They're like, what did I do wrong? I couldn't get it going. Basically, the money dried up. And when the money dried up, nobody could do anything about it. And they got caught in these, like, disastrous spin cycles of these modification programs and what you do. There's 10 million of us out there. Who knows how many in the position that I was in, because a lot of people in this community especially got in way over their heads. They had way too many homes. They were building like crazy. They didn't have any, so they didn't think there were any limits. And then when the music stopped, basically they all, you know, went bankrupt overnight.
It was a challenging time. We as a country are still dealing with it. We need to wrap up, but before we leave, I want to give you a chance to share with our audience, folks that want to see the film, how can they watch it?
Well, the first thing you can do is you can go to, I'd recommend checking out our Facebook site, Forward 13 on Facebook first, but and then everymansuperpack.com. But also Cinema Libre Productions, we're in a variety of digital formats right now, from Hulu, Netflix, and so forth, and then you can buy it on DVD from Amazon. But we're also going to go on a national tour, probably starting here, in a short period of time, that's going to basically follow the same pathway that we did in the film and hopefully end up in D.C. this summer. So we're going to do a bunch of one-offs with people that were in the film all over the country as well. We think this is like the blob, if you will, in terms of a marketing strategy, because the audience is so huge. We're just putting it out into every sort of device, every platform, and then hopefully we'll get critical mass. And if we can connect with 1% of the people that were impacted by this disaster, I think we'll have a big success on our hands.
Well, Patrick, we thank you for joining us. Our guest is Patrick Lovell. He's a Park City local and the director of Forward 13. And Patrick, before I let you go, I just want to share my favorite part of your film, which was the touching scene of you in the cemetery talking to your grandfather. He seemed like an amazing man. I wish we had time to find out more about him, but unfortunately we need to wrap up. But thank you for that movie. It was thought-provoking, and I enjoyed it.
Well, I appreciate the time, gentlemen, and I'll summarize my grandfather this way. He said, "You live a long and healthy life, but the last word you hear be mine," and I hear his voice every day.
Very fine. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with Mountain Money after this.
Are you ready for the games?
No, not those games.
The Groovy Pledge Drive of Love games.
Oh, that sounds intriguing. Tell me more.
Well, people are rushing to sign up. February 10th through February 14th, we'll have the Challenging Challenge Grant Challenge.
Primo Premium Pledge Play.
And online auction bidding bonanza.
You can play all week.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay tuned.
Park City Realty Group is a proud sponsor of KPCW's Mountain Money. This is Mike Mazzoni, principal broker and owner of Park City Realty Group. 100% locally owned and operated, Park City Realty Group provides boutique real estate services to buyers and sellers in the area. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. And we now have on the line, I guess because you're home, Jesse, caring for a child under the weather, but we have Jesse Shetler with us. His latest venture is the Boneyard Saloon. Welcome to Mountain Money, Jesse.
Well, hello there, and thank you very much for having me. I appreciate you guys working with me on the phone here.
That's fine. First of all, certainly your restaurants so far, aside from the Boneyard, are well-known. Tell us, fill in our audience on what enterprises you have along Main Street.
Well, I've recently formulated a company called Diversified Bars and Restaurants with a few partners. I'm the principal owner. So what we have are No Name Saloon and Grill and also Butcher's Chop House and Bar.
Okay, and now the latest venture is the Boneyard, and this is an entirely different concept because it is off of Maine, well off Maine, and what's your philosophy here? More of a neighborhood tavern kind of thing?
Yeah, we have Boneyard Saloon and Kitchen, and not only is it closer to my house, making it easier for me, but we thought the location at the yard where Bonanza Park Development is going to be was a prime location for the folks that live in Thames Canyon Park, Meadows, and Prospector Square, along with Iron Horse, Fireside, and the surrounding homestead.
Don't forget the guys at Ranch Place. We come out there occasionally, too.
Oh, God bless you. Thank you very much.
So this is unusual in another situation as well, right? I have not yet been there. I was hoping to get there over the weekend, but wasn't able to. My understanding is you guys are above the Blind Dog. Do people walk through the Blind Dog restaurant to get to your bar, or how does that work?
No, actually, that restaurant occupies the front space of the old lumberyard. We are behind them, between the event center and their restaurant.
So you're a separate facility, completely separate?
Completely separate, no affiliation other than being on the same property there. We have the same landlord. But the restaurant and bar is, like I said, is a diversified bar and restaurant organization with separate affiliation, separate entry, the whole shot.
So because of its location and the fact that there's parking in front and it's not really a destination tourists are going to drop into on their walk up and down Main Street, do you cater more to locals? Is this going to be a locals hangout?
That is exactly the reason why we wanted to go over there, why we wanted to be at that location. We want the locals to find us first. If you might recognize the fact that we haven't done very much advertising. We haven't really spread the word too much. We've kind of gone under the radar like a speakeasy might. What we're trying to do is let the local community know that we're here for them. We want to gain their support, their patronage, before the tourists find out that we're there. I think it'll be a great destination for all, but we're kind of hidden away here in the jewel of Park City.
Do you find locals during peak travel periods stay away from Main Street?
I find that more and more as the years go on. I live in Park Meadows, and I have neighbors that haven't been to either one of my establishments in years, and it really boils down to the difficulty of parking, traffic, parking, and they tend not to want to wait in line, and I don't blame them.
Jesse, I hear that a lot about the parking, but between the China Bridge parking facility and then the parking lot at Lower Swede, now I tend to go out to eat earlier than most people. I usually like to eat like 5:30 to 6:30 at the latest.
Right.
But, I find even when it's busy, outside of Sundance is a different situation, but even when it's busy, I typically can find parking convenient for Main Street as well.
You find parking convenient?
Yes, I usually can find a spot in one of those two locations. Now, I might be giving away my parking secrets here, and I won't be able to do it anymore. But.
Yeah, right. Hang on to those secrets. Hang on to them.
Well, maybe it's also partly perception, I would think. People just
that's
go,
my point. I think it's more.
I
think it's more perception
there,
than
yeah.
anything else.
Yeah, I think this is a whole other interview about parking. But if you got a couple of great spots, save them and enjoy the No Name and Butcher Shop out for sure.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the Boneyard. It is in the yard. Does this mean that the developer of Bonanza Park, Mark Fisher, intends to keep that old Anderson Lumberyard building around for years and years? Are you in a permanent location, or is that building going to come down at some point?
Yeah, I can answer that. As to the respect that the power station is no longer moving, Mark Fisher and John Paul, his partner there, has said that the location that the Boneyard and is in will be staying. So I signed a very long lease with Bonanza Park. So we're here to stay. We are going to grow with Bonanza Park. That's our intention. And I think it's going to be a great, great off Main Street location. And I'm talking about Bonanza Park as a whole, as to whatever what level that they build to now. I know that they have to change the floor plan. Excuse me. I know that they have to change the floor plan of the entire development now that the power station is not moving. But we're here. we're here early and we want to grow with Bonanza Park.
So, Jesse, tell us about the type of food that you're serving. What kind of meal can people expect to get when they go there, and what kind of price point are you targeting?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm proud to say that I think everybody's familiar with Shea Betty. It was there for 17 or 18
sure.
years. And when Jerry and his brother Tom closed Shea Betty down 8 or 10 months ago, Jerry went to work at one of the Deer Valley resorts here and worked there for 5 or 6 months and didn't seem to be a great fit for him. So he and I, who have we've been friends for 20 years, and I'm talking about Jerry Garcia specifically here, we've been friends for 20-plus years. We got to talking about what I was doing over here. So I'm proud to say that we have Jerry Garcia as our chef here. And the food has just been tremendous. So what I've got is what I would consider a fine dining chef putting a very high quality spin on what I would refer to as comfort food here at the Boneyard. And it has just been, we've been getting a great, great response from the local community.
So give us an idea of a couple of menu items.
Well, we've got a slab of baby back ribs. He's got we've got an array of burgers. We have a burger menu which is absolutely outstanding. It's a three blend burger menu, and we also have a completely wood and charcoal fired grill here. So everything you're getting is either being cooked with hints of apple wood or cherry wood or some sort of a hardwood fuel. And food has just been phenomenal. We have, there are chicken sandwiches and let's see what else.
Getting back to Doug's question, is this an off-main price point? Are you able to price this a little better?
Yeah, we're shooting everything between 10 and the highest priced menu item is $22, which would be the flat iron steak, I believe.
Okay, well, thanks very much for joining us, Jesse. Latest venture now open at the Boneyard. What are your hours? And again, repeat the location for folks who may want to try it.
Okay, Boneyard Saloon and Kitchen is located at 1251 Kearns at the Yard. And our hours of operation are every day from 11 a.m. until closing at 1 a.m. We're open for lunch, dinner, and late night.
Okay, very fine. Jesse Shetler, co-owner of the Boneyard Butcher's Chop House and the No Name. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Thanks, Jesse.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Underwriting on KPCW is supported by Mountain West Bank in Park City, a community bank offering home financing service and guidance. Mountain West Bank is located near Kearns Boulevard next to the movie theater. More information at mountainwestbank.com. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Just because it's white outside doesn't mean you can't stay green.
Listen to This Green Earth every Tuesday at 9 a.m.
Discussing environmental issues from methane gas to moose habitat.
Air quality to fire ecology.
And bark beetles to eating bugs.
That's This Green Earth, brought to you by
Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanities Restore, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
And speaking of Green Earth, you're going to want to join Nell and Chris tomorrow. They've got a very timely topic with the inversion down in Salt Lake City that's been plaguing folks. They've got author Dr. Deborah Davis. He's a world-renowned epidemiologist, and he's also the author of When Smoke Ran Like Water, and it talks about the history of air pollution in the U.S. and the impact on our health. So it's a timely topic. You're going to want to listen in.
And I want to thank our great sponsors today, Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, Prudential Real Estate, and San Francisco Design. Thanks so much, all of you, for helping to support the public affairs hours and specifically Mountain Money. Some snow in the forecast for tonight and tomorrow, and it's going to come in colder, so it should come in as snow, Doug. And in the last minute, you're a stocks guy. Is the Super Bowl any indicator of the year ahead in stocks?
Oh, it probably is for somebody. I don't know that. A lot of people are talking about the January effect now, which, you know, my comment on that is I wish it were that easy to predict what the market's going to do. But overall, you know, the U.S. economy continues to do pretty well. This is an important week. The jobs report comes out on Friday, and hopefully that's a healthy sign. The last jobs report was weak, so I think the whole market's going to be watching that.
Okay, and I want to remind folks also that KPCW's pledge drive begins next Monday. This is when we come to you twice a year to keep us on the air. So if you enjoy the programming here, we hope you will be calling in next week, Monday through Friday, for the KPCW Pledge Hour. And this is KPCW Park City.